Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino, a pair of dice in his hands and a stack of brightly colored chips in front of him. A sea of boisterous onlookers pressed against the outstretched arms of security guards wearing earpieces. As if alone on an island, Tiger ignored the ruckus and tossed his dice. It was nearly midnight on Friday, April 19th, and he was giving Elon a little taste of Vegas before the start of his annual fundraising extravaganza, known as Tiger Jam. Actors, musicians, and other athletes crowded around, shouting encouragement at Tiger. Finally, Barkley showed up, drawing grins and nods with his loud commentary. "I've played with Phil and all those guys, and Tiger does things they can't do," Barkley said. "They're intimidated by Tiger. They're soft as shit. Black Jesus scares them." Elon rolled with it. The atmosphere was a far cry from studying psychology in Sweden, but she was in love. Soon afterward, the internet was flooded with risque images from Elon's photo shoot with Bingo Romare, including one particularly sultry image of her posing topless and cupping her breasts. The tabloids ran salacious headlines, referring to her as Tiger's sexy Swede. The New York Post called her a tantalizing cross between Pamela Anderson and Cindy Margolis. Back in Sweden, the tabloids got so out of hand that they ran nude images, falsely claiming that they were of Elon. Tiger responded by putting out a statement saying she had never posed nude and had no plans to do so in the future. One of the reasons she didn't date him right away was because she didn't want to be just a celebrity girlfriend, Romare said. Elon is not like that. She's a smart girl, raised in a family of intellectuals. She has dreams. She didn't want to be seen just as a decoration on Tiger's arm. But there she was, on Tiger's arm. Chapter 21. Changes 2. From the start, the atmosphere at the 2002 U.S. Open at Bethpage Black on Long Island in New York felt more like a Giants football game at the Meadowlands than a golf tournament. The New York fans boisterously shouted, chanted, and cheered at decibel levels that exceeded anything Woods had heard in his entire career. But the loudest ovations weren't for him. They were reserved for the number two ranked golfer in the world, Phil Mickelson. Tiger had never particularly liked Mickelson and went out of his way to badmouth him, routinely referring to him as Phony Phil. It was Tiger's preferred means of exerting control over a competitor while at the same time keeping as much distance as possible between them. Although Mickelson, about to turn 32, had yet to win a major championship, Tiger recognized that he had emerged as a rival worth watching. Tiger's disdain for Mickelson went beyond the ropes, though. Mickelson was a perennial fan favorite with his everyman image, which Tiger, like many regulars on tour, felt was artificial. Mickelson had a beautiful wife and two young children, and they were frequently around him on the tour. In the final round at Bethpage, Mickelson had to back away from the 15th tee when the "Let's Go Mickelson" chants grew too loud. It was Mickelson's birthday, and on the 17th tee, his fans sang happy birthday to him. But like a well-oiled machine, Tiger led from start to finish, never allowing Mickelson to get close enough to inspire any hope. While he drew his share of cheers, Tiger didn't engage the fans as his rival did. Instead, he wore a scowl throughout on his way to capturing his eighth major championship. His dour demeanor prompted Sports Illustrated senior writer Michael Silver to posit afterward, "Has any pro golfer, hell, any great athlete ever looked so grim while doing his job?" One problem may have been boredom. It had taken Tiger just 22 majors to win 8 times. Nicklaus, in contrast, needed 35 majors to collect his first 8 wins. With his triumph at Bethpage, Tiger had won 7 of the last 11 major championships. There was no one to really challenge him. His only source of stimulation came from his obsession with continually getting better, a compulsion at the root of a slow-forming rift between him and Butch Harmon. Personally, they still got along fine, but Tiger had lost interest in Harmon's philosophy. Essentially, Harmon felt that Tiger had perfected his swing and simply needed to maintain it with subtle refinements, an opinion that was supported by the fact that Tiger was in the midst of a 264-week run as the number one ranked golfer in the world. Maintenance, however, was a word Tiger hated. He was a man in constant search of something he couldn't find. It made him a hard person to be around, much less to like, even for his friends. He was so consumed with being the greatest golfer ever, he He wasn't a very social guy, said Charles Barkley. Golf is just a game. But when your whole life revolves around how you're doing on a golf course, you're going to develop a negative attitude to a certain degree instead of saying, I've actually got it pretty good. Harmon more or less agreed with Barkley. The difference was that Harmon had to work with Woods, and the brunt of Tiger's obsession with perfection was felt most acutely by those who worked with him in a professional capacity. They were expected to perform at the same level of perfection that Tiger did. When that didn't happen, it could be cold and unforgiving. 2 months after winning the U.S. Open, Tiger froze out Harmon at the PGA Championship at Hazeltine. A few days earlier, Woods had telephoned Harmon with the news that their partnership was at an end. You know, I really just want to do this on my own, he said. Thank you for everything you've done for me, how you've helped me with my swing, but I'm going to go on my own. Harmon was shocked that Woods had mustered the courage to make the call. Between the ropes, he's the toughest son of a bitch to compete against I've ever seen, Harmon said in 2017. But he's not good at looking you in the eye and saying something. A couple days after the call, Tiger was on the practice tee at the PGA Championship when Harmon showed up. Ignoring him, Tiger kept swinging. Stung, Harmon walked off. Just like that, after 9 years together, the relationship was over. Harmon's departure marked the start of an unprecedented drought for Tiger. He finished second at the PGA, losing by one stroke. 34 months would pass before he would win another major championship. Injury contributed to the start of the drought. At the end of 2002, Woods flew to Park City, Utah to undergo arthroscopic surgery to remove benign cysts on his knee and drain some fluid. But during the procedure, doctors Thomas Rosenberg and Vern Cooley determined that his anterior cruciate ligament was significantly compromised. They told him he had about 20% of his ACL left. Tiger's question was simple. How long will that last? The answer was complicated. It was only a matter of time before his ACL was gone altogether, which then would require a more significant surgery. In the meantime, he was going to have to modify his approach. Mark O'Meara owned a condo in Park City, and he had escorted Tiger to the surgery. Afterward, O'Meara and Tiger met up with O'Meara's swing coach, Hank Haney, who owned a condo nearby. The conversation quickly turned to Tiger's ACL and the challenges it posed. I'm going to have to change my swing, he told Haney. While sitting out of the first five tournaments of 2003, Tiger aggressively rehabbed and managed to return to the tour in mid-February at the Buick Invitational in San Diego. Despite playing in pain, Woods won the tournament. Then, after finishing tied for fifth at the Nissan Open, he took the WGC Accenture Match Play Championship and the Bay Hill Invitational. Heading into the 2003 Masters, he looked primed for a third straight green jacket. But as was his wont, Woods was trading pain and potentially debilitating injury for the trophies that mattered most. At the same time, he had redoubled his weightlifting routine, working out twice a day, morning and night, for as much as 90 minutes at a time. As a result, his upper body, particularly his chest and shoulders, continued to get bigger, which was affecting his swing. With Harmon no longer in the picture, Tiger was determined to figure things out on his own. On the course, he even started giving his caddy the silent treatment. On Sunday at Augusta, just three off the lead to start the round, Tiger ignored Williams' advice to use the driver on the third hole and ended up flaring his tee shot wide right, forcing him to double bogey. In response, Tiger didn't say a word to Williams for the better part of 2 hours. On the ninth fairway, Williams had finally had enough. Pull your head out of your arse and start behaving like an adult, Williams told him. If I'd given you the wrong club and it cost you double bogey, then fair enough. But don't hit a shitty shot and tell me it's the wrong club. Tiger said nothing. Get your shit together and stop acting like a child, Williams told him. Tiger finished, tied for 15th. He ended up smoothing things out with Williams, but in a larger sense, the break with Harmon was indicative of Tiger's arriving at a point where he was shedding those who had been with him the longest. Back on January 1, 1997, just months after Tiger had turned pro, Nike had assigned Greg Nard to be a liaison between Woods and the corporate office. Working under the umbrella of the company's athlete relations program, Nard was officially a business affairs manager with Nike Golf. Unofficially, he was part of Nike's so-called Guy program, a personal concierge service reserved, at that point, for just two other Nike athletes, Michael Jordan and Ken Griffey Jr. It was Nard's responsibility as Tiger's guy to communicate all business-related issues involving apparel, footwear, equipment, and advertising to Woods, and coordinate directly with the product teams. In addition, Nard oversaw all Nike-related appearances and scheduling for Woods, as well as for select other sponsors. It was his job to ensure that Tiger knew where he needed to be, and if push came to shove, to end an interview or photo shoot that was running past its prescribed time limit. Greg was the funnel for everything Tiger-related, said Chris Mike, former director of marketing for Nike Golf. I couldn't just pick up the phone and call Mark Steinberg. Greg was the guy. Tall, good-looking, and African-American, Nard had been a starting point guard at Maryland before joining Nike. In many ways, he had the perfect temperament for his job, which landed him deep inside Woods' inner circle and often on the receiving end of Tiger's biting sense of humor. Woods was like a hammer and Nard his nail, constantly getting hazed by the star he was responsible for helping. Nard took everything in stride, embracing the pivotal role of navigating Tiger through the uncharted waters of extreme fame and fortune. Not surprisingly, Tiger could be demanding, especially when it came to things like selecting the perfect rainwear. It had to fit just so, and could not restrict his swing. And when there was blowback, Nard was often the recipient. At Nike, athletes of Woods' wattage were never wrong. Through it all, Nard absorbed the blows and treated Woods like a brother. Eventually, however, the brotherly bond began to fray, especially after Woods learned the corporate ropes and his patience grew thin when it came to Nike's response to his input and needs. Within a year, Tiger decided to make a change. He left it to Kel Devlin to break the news to Nard. It was a nightmare to tell Greg he wasn't going to be Tiger's guy anymore and have it not come from Tiger, said Devlin. That was part of the job I did that was not fun. Dating from his days at Stanford, there had long been a cold side to Woods. He never let anyone get too close to him. Harmon and Nard knew him as well as anyone, other than perhaps O'Mara and Steinberg. There was probably no one who spent more one-on-one time with Tiger between 1996 and 2003 than his swing coach and personal aide de camp. Taking them off the team was like removing the guardrails from the curves of a high-speed freeway. Tiger still won 5 tournaments in 2003, but after March he managed to win only twice. He was essentially a non-factor in all 4 major championships. He was out of sync, and he knew it. O'Mara knew it too, but he was searching for the right opportunity to broach the subject of what to do about it. Then, early in 2004, the two of them flew together on Tiger's Gulfstream G500 to the Middle East for the Dubai Desert Classic, where O'Mara ended a 5-year winless streak with a surprising victory. As he walked off the 18th green following the final round, Tiger was waiting for him. "I'm as happy for you right now as you are," he told O'Mara. Coming from Tiger, that statement had huge significance, and O'Mara knew it. Tiger seldom showed concern for others. Feeling confident, O'Mara decided to finally speak up. "Tiger," he said during the flight back, "you've got to get someone to help you with your game." Woods almost seemed relieved. "Who should I get?" he asked. O'Mara suggested Butch Harmon's brother, Billy. Tiger quickly shot that idea down. Too many potential complications in hiring the sibling of his prior coach. They kicked around a couple of other names, none of which resonated with Woods. Finally, O'Mara suggested his own instructor. "Tiger, I know Hank's my friend and I've been with him for years, but he's the best teacher in the world," he said. "Yeah, I know," he said. "I'm going to call him tomorrow." Hank Haney first met Tiger and Earl Woods in 1993 when they were in Dallas for the Byron Nelson Classic. Tiger was a 17-year-old amateur at the time, and he'd been invited to play in the tournament on a sponsor's exemption. Haney was then a private instructor for Tripp Keeney and his 2 siblings. Keeney's father took Earl and Tiger to meet Haney at his training facility north of Dallas. It was a frosty introduction. Congratulating Tiger on his accomplishments, Haney extended his hand. Tiger limply shook it and said nothing. Earl seemed even less interested in saying hello to Haney. 3 years later, after Tiger moved to Isleworth, Haney started running into him on the practice range. Haney would be there working with O'Mara, and Tiger would often join them for dinner afterward. There were also plenty of times at tournaments when Harmon and Haney were with Tiger and O'Mara during practice rounds. Still, Haney never imagined that one day he would end up coaching the man he considered the greatest golfer who ever lived. But hours after Tiger and O'Meara returned home from Dubai, O'Meara's agent, Peter Malik, called Haney and told him he was going to be receiving a phone call. The next day, March 8, 2004, Haney was having dinner with his father in Plano, Texas, when his cell phone rang. He stepped out and took the call. "Hey, Hank, this is Tiger." "Hey, bud," Haney said. True to form, Tiger dispensed with any small talk. "Hank, I want to know if you'll help me with my golf game." "Sure, Tiger, of course," he said, trying to conceal his enthusiasm. Tiger told him he wanted him in Isleworth on Monday morning. The call lasted a mere 3 minutes. Thoughts raced through Haney's head. "I've won the lottery. I'm going to gain in stature. I'm going to be famous. I'm going to get to try out all my ideas on The Ultimate Student. And he's going to prove them so right." After a few minutes, he went back inside and told his father the news. A lifelong Nicklaus fan, Haney's father chuckled with pride. "You know," he said a few minutes later, "that's going to be a hard job. Are you sure you want to do it?" A month earlier, Tiger Woods had formed a company in the Cayman Islands for the sole purpose of purchasing a 155-foot yacht. He named his new company Privacy Limited, and he named the yacht the same thing. According to court records, Privacy was intended to be a respite for the Woods family to relax and escape the rigors of their celebrity. At that point, the closest thing Tiger had to a family was Elin. They were living together in Isleworth and were engaged to be married. But Tiger treated the engagement like a state secret. The only people who were allowed to know about it were family and a few close friends, all of whom were sworn to secrecy. Elin had been with Tiger long enough that the burden of fame and Tiger's obsession with privacy had begun to rub off on her. Naturally inclined to trust others, she had become much more reserved and guarded, but she trusted Tiger implicitly, and she was in awe of his work ethic. On top of the tournaments, he was constantly on the road fulfilling obligations to his sponsors, making appearances, shooting commercials, and attending functions. He had earned over $200 million in endorsement money in the 3 years since they had started seeing each other, and with that came enormous demands on his time, so Elin never questioned his desire to escape on a yacht. She figured he deserved privacy. One of the few people who were invited to spend time on the yacht with Tiger and Elin was Tiger's dive instructor, Herb Sugden. In addition to teaching Elin to scuba dive, Sugden offered to teach Tiger how to spearfish. But he instantly discovered that Tiger's hand-eye coordination was so exceptional that all he had to do was hand Woods the spear gun and get out of the way. "I didn't have to teach him," Sugden said. "I just showed him once how to do it, and he did it. He's a better spearfisher than I am. He was phenomenal." Tiger liked Sugden and treated him exceptionally well. When he yearned for a greater feeling of adventure, he asked Sugden to teach him cave diving, a much riskier form of scuba diving that entailed going into underground caves that were full of water. At first, Sugden was apprehensive. At that time, Tiger was at the peak of his career, winning everything, Sugden said.
"Cave diving can be dangerous. You're underground and you're underwater. The only way to get air is what you got on your back, and the only way you can get out is to come back to the place you went in. You can get lost. It's a hazardous thing." But Tiger was fearless, and just as he had with scuba diving, he soon became a fully certified cave diver as well. It helped that he possessed an unusual ability to hold his breath longer than most humans. Nonetheless, his insurance carrier didn't like the fact that he was diving in caves. In an attempt to reassure his insurer, Tiger had Sugden meet with them. "I had to go up and tell them how safe cave diving was," Sugden said. On Monday morning, March 15, 2004, Tiger was standing in his driveway swinging a golf club. His custom-made golf cart was parked nearby with his clubs in the back. He was waiting for Hank Haney to arrive for their first practice session. When Haney pulled up in his rental car, Tiger walked over and said hello. "I'm looking forward to working with you," Haney said. Tiger wasted no time before telling Haney how things were going to be done. He had observed Haney plenty of times as he worked with O'Meara, and Tiger made it clear at the outset that he disagreed with some of his methods. It was a not-so-subtle way of saying that Haney was going to have to earn his trust. Tiger got into his cart and drove Haney toward a secluded area on the range. I want to get more consistent in every phase, he said on the way over. So I have the kind of game that at majors will always get me to the back nine on Sundays with a chance. I don't want to just have a chance on the weeks when I'm hot. I want to have a chance all the time. Haney knew he was dealing with more than a world-famous golfer. He considered Tiger's mastery of every facet of the game, right down to the equipment he used, downright intimidating. For instance, according to Kel Devlin, Nike had recently shipped a box of prototype titanium drivers to Woods so he could test them. There were six in total. After putting the drivers through their paces, Tiger told Devlin that he preferred the one that was heavier than the others. Devlin informed him that all six drivers were the exact same weight. Tiger argued otherwise, insisting that one weighed more than the others. To prove him wrong, Devlin sent the drivers back to the design wizards at the Nike testing facility in Fort Worth with instructions to weigh them. They found that five drivers were exactly the same weight, but the sixth was 2 grams heavier. When they pulled the club apart, they discovered that an extra dab of goo had been added to the inside of the head by one of the engineers to help absorb a few floating particles of titanium. The weight of the goo was the equivalent to the weight of 2 $1 bills, yet Tiger noticed the difference in the way the driver felt in his hands. With stories such as that in mind, Haney understood that it wasn't wise to consider Tiger his student. He knew Woods was testing him, and he wasn't about to get off on the wrong foot by arguing with him. As Tiger started to hit balls, they talked about the fact that he wasn't consistently able to get his upper body to rotate fast enough on his downswing. The other thing they worked on was getting Tiger's eyes to stay level through his swing. Woods' intensity on the practice range was beyond anything Haney had ever experienced. He proceeded gently through his first session. By the time he returned home, Haney had an agreement with Tiger to continue working with him. Haney would be earning $50,000 per year, the same amount Tiger had paid Harmon, and would receive a $25,000 bonus each time Tiger won a major championship. Later that week, Tiger played in the Bay Hill Invitational. After a strong first round, he played poorly, shooting 74, 74, and 73 to finish tied for 46th place. In his press conference afterward, he said that he was very excited about what he had worked on earlier in the week and that 90% of his game was good. But what he said publicly was almost always different from what he really felt. When Haney showed up at Isleworth the next day for his second round of practice sessions, Tiger was already on the range, hitting balls. He didn't look up when Haney reached the tee, nor did he respond when Haney pointed out a few things he had noticed in Tiger's swing during the Bay Hill Invitational. A couple of compliments from Haney didn't faze Tiger either. Silence was his way of sending a message. It was also his method for assessing weakness. "I'm not sure what you're doing here," Haney finally said. "But I guess you're trying to knock me off my spot. I know what you need to do to get better. I know what your plan needs to be. So if you're trying to knock me off my spot, it's not going to happen." Tiger still didn't acknowledge him, but when Haney suggested some new drills, he immediately executed them with passion and precision. The practice session was solid. The next day's session was even better, but Tiger stayed in silent mode, providing instant clarity to something Butch Harmon had said to Haney the first time he saw him after being succeeded as Tiger's coach. "Hank, good luck," Harmon told him. "It's a tough team to be on, and it's harder than it looks." The good news heading into the 2004 Masters was that Tiger was still the number one golfer in the world, and he felt no real pressure from his flanks. David Duval had been derailed by injuries. Sergio Crybaby Garcia had crumbled under the bright light of expectation, just 2 wins in 78 tour starts. Ernie Els appeared to be on his last legs. Vijay Singh was playing well but remained something of an outlier. The only guy Woods continued to think was capable of giving him a real challenge was Mickelson, who had earned his own nickname from Tita, Fat Boy. Despite 21 victories on tour, Mickelson had also earned the dreaded best player never to win a major label. Tiger felt that if Mickelson won just one major, the floodgates would open. In previous years, Woods had always been the one talking trash about Mickelson, but by 2004, Mickelson had become pretty good at talking shit himself. A year earlier, he'd done just that, expressing his surprise to Golf Magazine that Tiger had played so well given his inferior equipment, a jab at Nike clubs and balls. Woods brushed it off as simply Phil trying to be funny, and Phil being Phil. When Mickelson arrived in Augusta, he was eager to mix it up with Tiger. That was especially clear when Mickelson birdied 5 of the last 7 holes, including 18 in the final round to finally capture his first major championship. "I had a different feeling playing this week," Mickelson said afterward. "I didn't feel the anxiety of it slipping away, or how is the tournament going, or who is doing what. It was, let's hit some shots." Shots were exactly what Woods didn't hit. After finishing back in the pack, he wasn't about to stick around and congratulate Mickelson. Instead, he disappeared with his father to the place where Earl had been stationed as a Green Beret, Fort Bragg, North Carolina. They met up with a bunch of Earl's military buddies. Drawing on his father's military contacts, Tiger spent a few days doing Army Special Ops training. Wearing a camouflage uniform with his name above the left pocket, Tiger did 4-mile runs in combat boots, participated in hand-to-hand combat exercises, and did drills in wind tunnels. It was risky behavior, considering that he had a significantly compromised ACL, but Tiger's mind was elsewhere. Back in 1998, Earl had been diagnosed with prostate cancer, which was successfully treated with radiation. But in 2004, the cancer returned, and it was spreading through his body. He was also dealing with diabetes. Sensing that his father's days were numbered, Tiger wanted to be closer to him. The highlight of the trip was tandem jumping with the Army's parachute team. Strapped to a soldier, Tiger flung himself out of the jump plane. Exhilarated, Woods grinned as he dropped through the air. On the ground, Earl breathed with the aid of an oxygen tank as he waited in the drop zone. When Tiger landed, his father hugged him with pride. "Now you understand my world," Earl told him. Before leaving the base, Tiger sat with his father and listened to Earl's old Army buddies tell stories about him. It was the first time that Tiger had heard about his father's heroism in combat. The more he heard, the more he longed to live up to Earl's expectations. By the time Tiger showed up at the 2004 U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills, golf writers were openly talking about the fact that he was in another slump. In the previous 18 tournaments, he'd won just 2 times. Even Butch Harmon publicly criticized him. "Tiger Woods is not playing well," Harmon said on television during the tournament. "He's not working on the right things in his golf swing, although Tiger obviously thinks he is." Tiger hated it when anyone criticized him publicly, but it felt like a stab in the back to hear it coming from his former swing coach. He spent the weekend in a foul mood, barely setting foot in the locker room, avoiding everyone, and giving tour officials the "what the fuck do you want" look anytime they approached. Steve Williams played the role of human shield. On the very first hole of the tournament, in which Tiger finished 10 over and tied for 17th, Williams kicked a camera belonging to a pesky news photographer. In the final round, he confiscated an unauthorized camera from a fan, an off-duty police officer, as it turned out. Both player and caddy were at wit's end. The U.S. Open marked the 8th consecutive major championship without a win, the longest such stretch of Tiger's career. Afterward, Tiger was behind the wheel of his rental car headed back to the house that he had stayed in. Williams sat in the passenger seat. Suddenly, Tiger pulled over to the side of the road and hit his caddy with the verbal equivalent of a 9-iron to the gut. "Stevie," he said, "I think I've had enough of golf. I'd like to try to be a Navy SEAL." Stunned, Williams searched for something rational to say. All he could think of was this: "Don't you think you might be a bit old for that?" But Tiger was serious. He had practically worn out a basic underwater demolition SEAL training DVD that covered a 6-month training course. He had memorized every exercise, and many of the slogans on the video were ones he had started repeating as his own. Williams wasn't the only one who was concerned. Hank Haney had been spending a lot of time at Tiger's home in Isleworth, where he had observed Woods' fixation on a video game called SOCOM, U.S. Navy SEALs. Wearing headphones, he would respond to orders from an animated commander. Tiger would get totally immersed, Haney said, sitting on the edge of the couch as intense and focused as if he were playing in a major championship. The sudden and intense interest in Navy SEAL training coincided with the stepped-up workout routines and cardiovascular exercises. Tiger's quest resulted in additional upper body muscle mass, which forced him to significantly modify his golf swing yet again. One consequence of Butch Harmon's publicly chastising Tiger was that it sped up his bonding process with Haney. Whether intentional or not, Harmon's comments about Tiger were also swipes at Haney. They were both highly motivated to prove Harmon wrong, and it brought them together. After the 2004 U.S. Open, Tiger fully embraced Haney's approach to overhauling his swing. Early in the summer of 2004, the Boys and Girls Clubs honored Denzel Washington with a Lifetime Achievement Award at a black tie dinner held at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. The guest list was a virtual who's who of the Hollywood and sports industries. Tiger blew off the dinner, choosing instead to attend the after party in Denzel's suite. A couple of days later, he was with Elin at the clubhouse at Isleworth when he ran into a neighbor who had attended the dinner at the Waldorf. She knew Tiger had been invited, and she wondered why he'd skipped it. He explained that he'd gone to the after party. Elin had no idea what Tiger and their neighbor were talking about. Finally, she looked at Tiger and said, "You were in New York?" There were a lot of things Tiger didn't tell Elin, especially when it came to his whereabouts and the women he met on the road. His secret life in Las Vegas and all the temptations that besieged him begged the question, why get married? The answer may lie in the fairy tale life that Woods desired. A heart-stopping wife and adorable children living with him in the six-bedroom mansion on Deacon Circle that he had purchased 4 years earlier. It was the image that he saw in the marriage between Mark and Alicia O'Mara. For Tiger, Elin Nordegren represented the key piece of the puzzle. Blonde, beautiful, and adoring. They would live happily ever after, right down the street from the O'Maras. There was another important factor. Elin was the first woman who fully measured up to the lofty expectations of both Earl and Cultita. Tiger had been in love before, and he'd been very close to more than one woman who would have been much more likely to try to rein in his vices and insist that he stay on the straight and narrow. But it soon became clear that he wanted it both ways, the picture-perfect marriage and the freedom to walk on the wild side. In that respect, he was a lot like his father, but with one big difference, unlimited opportunity. On October 5, 2004, Tiger and Elin exchanged vows in Barbados at the ultra-exclusive Sandy Lane Resort. To ensure ultimate privacy, Tiger spent a reported $1.5 million to rent the entire resort for the week, filling the time with fishing, boating, golf, and snorkeling. On the night of the wedding, the island sky was ablaze with a spectacular display of fireworks. Only family and close friends were invited. Tiger spent his night sitting around with his father and Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley, smoking cigars and talking about glory days. Meanwhile, Cultita beamed. At age 28, her son was now a man in the fullest sense. Soon, she hoped, there would be a grandchild. Just before Christmas of 2004, Tiger and Elin went on their first getaway as a married couple, flying to Park City for a week of skiing with the O'Maras and the Haneys. For years, Tiger had been telling O'Mara he was going to try skiing. Now that he was married to an advanced skier who playfully bragged that she was much better than he was at the sport, Tiger was determined to show her that skiing was a lot simpler than golf. But he had one condition for going on the trip. He didn't want to be seen with a ski instructor. O'Mara promised to take care of everything. He talked to his friend Carl Lund, one of the top instructors in Utah. Lund had taught both of O'Mara's children to ski, and he was very connected at the luxurious Deer Valley Resort. At O'Mara's request, Lund talked to the resort and made special arrangements for Tiger to receive lessons outside the normal course of business. There would be no reservations and no payment. Lund would simply meet Tiger on the slopes and ski with him for the day. The mere fact that Tiger was going skiing with his swing coach was a graphic illustration of how much things had changed. When Butch Harmon was his swing coach, he used to bar Woods from shooting jump shots by himself for fear that he might jam a finger. Now Haney and O'Mara were encouraging Tiger to try downhill skiing. It was clear that Tiger had accepted Haney into his inner circle, viewing him as a friend. The feeling was mutual. The next morning, Tiger showed up on the slopes wearing a bulky knee brace. It had been almost 2 years to the day since his last knee surgery. His SEAL training exercises and intense weightlifting regimen had been putting increased stress on his troubled left knee, but he wasn't going to let that slow him down on the slopes. At first, he resisted any instruction. "Don't worry," he told the group, "I'll be fine." He started out slowly on the bunny slope. With Elin cheering him on, he soon moved off the beginner hill. After a short break for lunch, Tiger decided to try a more advanced run. Haney watched in fear as Tiger rapidly gained speed. Lund and O'Mara were partway down the slope when Woods flew by them. They estimated his speed at close to 40 miles per hour, and he was completely out of control. "Holy shit," Lund said, taking off after him. Tiger was balanced on his skis just enough to pick up speed and hung on for dear life as he headed straight for some aspen trees.
"Turn! Turn!"
everyone screamed. Suddenly, at the last second, Tiger turned just enough to avoid the trees, toppled, and landed flat on his back between two trees. Frightened, Lund skidded to a stop beside him. Out of breath and feeling exhilarated, Tiger looked up at him.
"Hey," Lund said, "are you okay with me helping you out with a few things?"
"That'd be great," Tiger said. Lund helped him up and dusted him off. Then he started teaching some basics, such as how to turn. "Skiing is basically left turns and right turns," he said, demonstrating what he meant, encouraging Tiger to follow. "Rights, lefts, rights, lefts. That's it," Lund said. "Up on your toes. Feel it?"
"Why doesn't this fucking ski turn?" Tiger barked. "This fucking ski doesn't turn."
"Just relax," Lund said. "Stay positive." After more than 25 simple turns, Tiger had had enough. He wasn't interested in drills. He wanted speed. But Lund wouldn't let him. "Get your shins against the front again," he said. Tiger just glared at him. Elon was watching, and he was pissed.
"You know what?" Lund said. "A really loud fuck you would make you feel better right now."
"Fuck you!" Tiger yelled.
"Do you feel better?"
Tiger grinned.
"Yeah."
Lund smiled. "Now get your shins against the front." He lasted about 10 minutes before he lost it again. He was Tiger fucking Woods. He didn't need to be taught. He knew what to do.
"Fuck you," he said to Lund again.
Determined not to let Tiger get hurt on his watch, Lund dug in, insisting that he not go downhill without learning how to turn properly. Tiger's natural inclination was to do what's known in ski jargon as crank and yank. Basically, every time he tried to turn, his skis would end up in a V-shape, the inside leg getting in the way and needing to be yanked around to complete the turn. But due to the downhill angle, the back of Tiger's ski was catching when he tried to twist, putting tremendous strain on his knee. Aware that he'd undergone ACL surgery, Lund didn't want him to do any long-term damage to the ligaments by learning an improper technique. The more they practiced, the more frustrated and surly Tiger became. As he finished his final run with Lund, Tiger saw Mara approaching. Without saying thank you or goodbye, Tiger started trudging toward the lodge.
"See you later," Lund said.
"Fuck you," Tiger said.
Lund couldn't believe it. He was the most experienced instructor on the mountain, and he had spent the afternoon working with Tiger as a courtesy. It was a fitting end to the most frustrating year in Tiger's career. In 2004, he had won just one of the 19 tournaments he entered. Phil Mickelson had won the Masters and was no longer afraid of him, and in September, Tiger had been toppled from the number one ranking in the world by Vijay Singh. Woods hadn't won a major championship since June 2002, and the whispers were growing louder that the Tiger era might be coming to an end. As an ailing and frustrated Woods removed his bulky knee brace in Park City, it certainly felt that way to him. On January 23, 2005, Tiger won the Buick Invitational at Torrey Pines. It was his first PGA tournament victory since he had begun working with Hank Haney 10 months earlier. During that period, Tiger had once again changed his swing, making major adjustments to his grip and retooling many of the things he had worked on with Harmon. This was the third major swing change of his career, and he and Haney still had a long way to go toward calming down his swing in hopes of avoiding injury and getting the new mechanics fully refined. But a win was a great way to start the 2005 PGA Tour season. Elin was particularly ecstatic. This was Tiger's first win since the wedding, and she had walked every hole of the final round with him. Afterward, back at the hotel, Elin leaned against him and said, "We have to celebrate. What should we do?" She brought up the fact that when she used to work for the Parnovics as a nanny, they would throw a party every time Jesper won.
"That's not what we do," Tiger told her. "I'm not Jesper. We're supposed to win."
Elin nodded, the smile shrinking from her face. There would be no celebration. Tiger's emotional detachment after victories was part of his formula for greatness. Even when he had played flawlessly, he acted as if he had simply done okay. The best was always yet to come. Tiger never allowed himself to be satisfied because in his mind, satisfaction is the enemy of success, said Haney. His whole approach was to delay gratification and somehow stay hungry. It's the way of the superachiever. The more celebrations, the less there'll be to celebrate. It was an attitude that kept him motivated week after week, but it took a toll on his relationships. Nevertheless, Elin quickly molded her approach to his, stifling her enthusiasm and hiding her emotions. It was the Woods' way. The one opponent who generated a different, more visceral reaction from Tiger was Phil Mickelson. He wouldn't admit it publicly, but Tiger viewed Mickelson differently after he won the Masters in 2004. He had proven himself to be a serious contender, and while Tiger was in the midst of a swing change, Mickelson saw vulnerability. Weeks after the win at Torrey Pines, Tiger ended up in a head-to-head battle with Mickelson at Doral. Woods ended up sinking a 30-foot birdie putt on the 17th hole to finally put Lefty away. The win restored Tiger to the number one ranking he had briefly lost to Vijay Singh in 2004. More important, Tiger sent a direct message to Mickelson, "I'm still better than you." Afterward, he came as close as he would get to expressing joy after a win. "That one meant a little more, huh?" Haney asked him. "Oh, yeah," Tiger said. "Any time I can beat that guy." Still, there was no celebration. Chapter 22. Unplayable Lie. In the spring of 2005, Charles Barkley's Who's Afraid of a Large Black Man was published. An instant bestseller, the book was co-written with Washington Post columnist Michael Wilbin and featured a collection of candid conversations on race with prominent figures including Bill Clinton, Morgan Freeman, Jesse Jackson, Marion Wright Edelman, and Ice Cube. Barkley also included a chapter featuring a conversation with Woods. In it, Tiger claimed he was the target of a violent racist attack when he was 5 years old. This is an excerpt from what Woods said in Barkley's book. "I became aware of my racial identity on my first day of school, on my first day of kindergarten. A group of sixth graders tied me to a tree, spray painted the word nigger on me, and threw rocks at me. That was my first day of school, and the teacher really didn't do much of anything. I used to live across the street from school and kind of down the way a little bit. The teacher said, 'Okay, just go home.' So I had to outrun all these kids going home, which I was able to do." This was not the first time Woods has told this story about his first day in elementary school. By 2005, he had been repeating it in one form or another for well over a decade. But the version that he told Barkley was the most sensational account to date. As best as can be determined, the tale was first told by Earl Woods, who shared it with Golf Magazine in 1992 when Tiger was 16 years old. In that telling, Earl claimed that Tiger was the only black student at Cerritos Elementary School and that he had been tied to a tree by some older classmates. 1 year later, the story resurfaced in a Los Angeles Times profile on Tiger. From there, the story grew. In his seminal profile on Tiger Woods for Sports Illustrated at the end of 1996, Gary Smith wrote the following about the incident. "What happened was a gang of older kids seizing Tiger on his first day of kindergarten, tying him to a tree, hurling rocks at him, calling him monkey and nigger. And Tiger, at age 5, telling no one what happened for several days, trying to absorb what this meant about himself and his world." The following year, in the biography of Tiger supported by Earl and Cultita, journalist John Strege described the incident as a shocking introduction to racism wherein Woods was tied to a tree by a group of older white boys, taunted with racial slurs, and pelted with rocks. Later in 1997, Woods was interviewed by Barbara Walters, who asked him about the first time he experienced any kind of discrimination. He responded by repeating the kindergarten story, but he added a new twist, saying, "I was tied to a tree by the sixth graders and had, nigger written on me and rocks thrown at me, and I was bleeding all over the place and went home." No single story fueled the Tiger Woods racial narrative more powerfully than his account of being the victim of a brazen hate crime at the age of 5. But under scrutiny, the incident seems to be made up. Low-lying and the color of creamed coffee, Cerritos Elementary School first opened its doors in September 1961. It sits alongside a 5-lane boulevard right across from a local park. In 2016, when we visited the school, its 2 kindergarten classrooms were still housed in the far southwest corner of the building, completely separating kindergartners from the rest of the students, just as they were on September 14, 1981, the first day of school for 5-year-old Eldrick Woods. Tiger's kindergarten teacher, Maureen Decker, remembers some details from that day like it was yesterday. She also remembers 20 years later when she was watching a televised interview with Tiger and first heard him turn that day into a scene from a Spike Lee film. "I was flabbergasted," said Decker. "I almost fell out of my chair at home when I heard him say that because I knew it was absolutely untrue. It never happened. How did the sixth graders get past me or the other teacher on duty? It never happened. It makes no sense that we would ever let sixth graders come out to the kindergarten playground in the first place." The two kindergarten classes at Cerritos were connected by a workroom for the teachers. Just outside the classrooms, there was a large playground completely fenced in. Only kindergarten students had access to the playground. In 2016, Jim Harris, the longtime director of maintenance, operations, and transportation for the Savannah School District, which includes Cerritos, provided a walking tour of Tiger's former kindergarten playground. The entire area had a concrete surface and was fully enclosed by a 5-foot-high chain-link fence and a single gate. The grounds also featured 2 mature trees. Kindergarten students, Harris pointed out, are always supervised, especially on the first day of school, adding to the improbability of Tiger's account. "I can't understand how that could have happened," he said of the alleged incident. "The kids are very, very protected. They're so guarded." Woods also claimed that, after the incident, he immediately ran a few short blocks home. But in addition to having to leave a fenced-in area without being stopped by teachers, parents, or administrators, he would have had to cross 5 lanes of traffic in front of the school without raising the suspicion of a crossing guard. All of which begs the question, how did a 5-year-old get tied to a tree on a concrete playground, have the word nigger spray-painted or written on his body, be pelted with rocks until he was covered in blood, untie himself, escape, and make it across 5 lanes of traffic while being chased by older kids without anyone's witnessing any element of this story? There's more. In the official Tiger Woods DVD collection released in 2004, Earl Woods claimed that the incident took place in first grade, not kindergarten, and that Tiger didn't tell him about it for 2 or 3 days. Earl also claimed that at his urging, Cerritos principal Donald Hill investigated the incident and provided Earl with a report, and that the kids involved were punished. Hill flatly denied Earl's account. "I have never heard of that story," he said in 2003. "Something that was that serious, I would question why didn't the father come to me and complain. It certainly didn't come to my office." In response to a specific request for any reports or documentation related to a racial incident involving Tiger Woods during either kindergarten or first grade, Dr. Sue Johnson, superintendent of the Savannah School District, said in an email, "There are no reports of any kind related to the alleged incident." So why tell this story if the incident never happened? Perhaps the best answer can be found in one of the more famous phrases ever to exit Earl Woods' mouth, "Let the legend grow." It was a reference to Tiger's image. Earl, who fashioned himself a media expert, knew the impact that adding an incendiary racial element would have in burnishing the story of the Chosen One. Claims of racism and bigotry, whether real or imagined, injected a powerful element into the narrative. When Tiger arrived at Augusta for the 2005 Masters, he hadn't won a major championship since the U.S. Open in 2002. During practice sessions leading up to the tournament, he felt he was hitting the ball better than he had at any time previously in his life. But midway through a rain-shortened third round, he trailed Chris DeMarco by 4 strokes. That night, before going to sleep, Woods received a text from Haney. "All you have to do is what you're doing. There is no one here who can beat you, even if it takes you extra holes. This is your tournament." Tiger's relationship with Haney had crystallized. Although he rarely thanked Haney or said anything positive about his teaching methods, Woods was thriving under him. More than anything, he trusted Haney. By the time the final round began on Sunday, Woods led DeMarco by 3 shots, thanks to a streak of 7 straight birdies on his way to a third round 65. But his lead had dwindled to just 1 as he stared down his second shot on the par 3 16th, known as Redbud. With a 4th green jacket on the line, Tiger had left his tee shot long and left of the pin, against a 2nd cut of rough in an area that Steve Williams had never scouted. The stage was set for one of the most dramatic chip shots in history. Time and time again in his hotel room, alone or with friends, Woods had practiced chipping blindly over a bed into a bathroom cup. Far more often than not, he either hit the cup or dunked the shot. A wedge had come to feel like a magic wand in his hands. and like a magician unveiling his most famous trick, Woods now hit a skipping pitch that paused on a faint ball mark, the exact spot Woods wanted, before drawing down the slope, funneling closer and closer to the hole. The ball's progress tracked with the crowd's cheers and Vern Lundquist's classic call on television, "Here it comes. Oh my goodness." The ball paused on the lip of the cup as if to catch its breath, its Nike swoosh perfectly on display, before toppling into the hole for a birdie. A roar thundered through the Augusta Pines as Tiger smacked Williams's outstretched hand and thrust his club into the air. "Oh, wow," Lundquist shouted. "In your life, have you seen anything like that?" Nobody had. The shot was a supernatural display of imagination, touch, and control that encapsulated the brilliance of Tiger Woods. As a human being, he might not have been lovable or even likable, but as a performer, he possessed unsurpassed talents that he honed through a lifetime of practice. On Sunday afternoons, he shared his gifts with millions, enabling them to forget reality and vicariously experience thrills that were more exhilarating than anything felt in a church pew. Golf had never meant so much to so many. The next morning, still basking in the glow of Woods' ninth major championship, Phil Knight, Kel Devlin, national sales manager Doug Holt, and three other Nike execs hopped onto Knight's plane for a champagne-soaked flight back to Portland. By Tuesday morning, Jim Riswald and his team at Wieden Kennedy had cut three inspiring Just Do It commercials bereft of any artifice, just Woods, a pulse-pounding soundtrack, and Lundquist at his poetic best. One cut was then embellished with a computer-generated starburst just as a bright white ball and an iconic blue swoosh disappeared into the hole. Riswald loved that version the best, but the other two were more traditional, which was the operative word at Augusta National. The club was allowing Nike to use footage from CBS Sports for no fee, but in exchange, it wanted final approval of any ad. When the commercials made their way to Glenn Greenspan, the man in charge of communications at Augusta, he nixed the starburst version on the spot, according to Riswald. Yet the commercial that did air served as a rocket launch for Nike Golf. Tiger's unforgettable shot marked a profound moment for his biggest corporate partner. Shortly after getting married, Wood sat for another interview with People magazine writer Steve Helling, who focused his attention on a single subject. "I knew that Elin was a special woman pretty soon after I met her," Tiger told him. "I knew that she was the one for me. She's a special person, and I know how lucky I am to have her. We're at the beginning of our life together, and that's an exciting place to be." Unlike the previous two times when Tiger had met with Helling, on this occasion, Woods asked a lot of questions. Helling had just covered the breakup of Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston, and Tiger wanted to know if Angelina Jolie was really the other woman. He also asked about Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise. Woods had never met any of these actors, but he talked about them as if they were all part of the same club. When Helling brought the conversation back around to Elin and asked why Woods had married her, he offered a superficial answer. "I married Elin because I see a long future with her," he said. Woods may have envisioned such a future, but his present, much like a critical part of his past, was proving to be a myth. Just months after making that statement to Helling, Tiger was back in Vegas, seated at his VIP table just off the dance floor at Light, the nightclub at Bellagio. His high school friend Byron Bell and his Stanford friend Jerry Chang were along for the ride. Woods spotted a woman in tight jeans and a form-fitting top that showed off her figure. She was partying with her friends when Tiger's VIP host approached with the magic words, "Tiger would love to meet you." 21-year-old Jamie Jungers was a small-town Kansas girl who had come to Las Vegas in search of good times and a better life. Standing 5'9" and weighing just 105 pounds, she quickly found part-time gigs as a model, doing some charity work with a group called Angels of Las Vegas. She also landed a job in construction that put a little money in her pocket. After being pulled away from her friends and pointed toward Tiger's table, she strolled up and Tiger greeted her. "You're gorgeous," he said. A few hours later, Jungers found herself more than a little drunk and alone with Woods in his suite at the mansion. The confidence he had long displayed on the golf course had found its way into the bedroom. It started out just making out, and then it turned very wild, she would later say about that initial encounter. "Different positions, it almost seemed like he had known me for a while, like he was comfortable with me already." During an interlude, she asked Woods if he was married. It wasn't very often that Tiger met a woman who didn't know his marital status, but Jungers didn't follow golf and hadn't paid attention to the tabloid coverage of his marriage to Elin. He told Jungers that his wife was back in Sweden visiting her twin sister. Jungers left the suite early the next morning, figuring it was a one-night stand. Then her phone rang later that day. "Hey, it's Tiger," he said. "I had a great time last night, and I'd love to see you again." It was the beginning of an 18-month affair filled with passion, a cute nickname, Tiger called her My Little Coffee Cup, and insight into Woods' deceptive method of operation. For starters, he gave Jungers his personal cell phone number and told her to store it under a different name. Next, Byron Bell checked in with Jungers. He was the facilitator, the one who passed her instructions from Tiger. The first place he wanted her was in Chicago in his hotel suite. From then on, every time Tiger wanted Jungers to fly somewhere, Bell would make all the travel arrangements, always in coach. "I would always go through Byron," Jungers said. Woods eventually brought Jungers to his villa in Vegas, where she learned that the words, "I'm Jamie and I'm with Tiger," opened the mansion's gate like Aladdin's cave. Years would pass before Jungers would discover that she was just one in a parade of women Woods was using for personal gratification. Like so many, she was swept up in the thrill of secret rendezvous with the most famous athlete in the world. When looking at Tiger's quest for sex outside of marriage, it's easy to rely on well-worn clichés such as "like father, like son," or "the apple doesn't fall far from the tree." Perhaps. But sex addiction experts see serial infidelity in a more complex light, particularly among high-powered narcissists used to being in control. In general, they say narcissists build a brick wall around their soft-hearted center and fragile self-esteem. Only after treatment do they come to realize that their vulnerability drives the addiction. What they think instead is, "I'm impenetrable." Another factor is something called conditional worth, which is self-worth that's based on performance. The more success, the more worth, and the more pressure, pressure that seeks release. Finally, there's the hero child living the legacy of his dad, which can lead to a concept known as eroticized rage, anger funneled into sex. "I could never rage at you when I was young and you were too strong, but now I can." For reasons that had nothing to do with his wife, Woods was never content to stay at home, nor did he limit his infidelity to Las Vegas. He was losing control over his impulses, straying from Elin right down the road from their idyllic home in Isleworth in Orlando nightclubs like the Roxy and Blue Martini. And just 2 months after Tiger and Elin were married, Club Paris opened in town. Owner Fred Kalilian paid Paris Hilton millions for the use of her name and occasional appearances. Tiger quickly became a familiar face, standing on the owner's balcony at 1 a.m, overlooking a jam-packed dance floor, cocktail in hand, waiting for the waitress he fancied to get off work. Woods liked to hang with Kalilian, smoking cigars in his huge office, talking sports. Kalilian knew celebrities, which meant he knew the shy, quiet guy sitting across from him was in pain. What he saw in Woods, he had seen in others. "I got to hang with Michael Jackson for a long time," said Kalilian. "Tiger reminded me a lot of Michael. He was that kid who never lived that childhood life, and he wanted to be bad. He wanted to do whatever he wanted. He wanted to do, in my opinion, what he thought he shouldn't do, because he always had to do what he was told to do." Yet there were no signs that his duplicitous life off the course was having any deleterious effect on his performance inside the ropes. On the contrary, Woods played some of the best golf in his life in 2005. He won 6 tour events, including the Masters and the British Open, while finishing in the top 4 at both the U.S. Open and the PGA Championship. He averaged a career-high 316.1 yards off the tee, second best on the tour, took home another scoring title, and was named PGA Tour Player of the Year for a record 7th time. On the cusp of turning 30, Tiger had done something far more remarkable than anything that could be measured in awards or statistics. Under Haney, he had reached a turning point in his new mechanics, and for the 3rd time in his career, he had mastered a new swing and established himself as the most dominant golfer in the world. Chapter 23. Loss. Leading up to his 30th birthday, Tiger took an unexplained 6-week hiatus from golf. During this period, there was a 24-day stretch, the longest in his career, when he didn't even touch his clubs. His absence during the first few tournaments on the PGA Tour schedule in 2006 coincided with a stormy transition underway in the Woods family. At issue was Earl's day-to-day care at the family home in Cyprus, where he was confined as he struggled through the final stage of cancer. At the end of December 2005, Caltita had placed an urgent telephone call to Earl's daughter, Royce, saying that Earl was in bad shape and desperately needed someone to be with him full-time. It was a full-blown family crisis, brought on by dysfunction and resentment. The fact was that Earl had been receiving